We're going to be looking at a passage which is one of my favorites, probably one of your favorites, Luke chapter 15. So if you can switch that on, it'd be great. It's simply incredible, and it's so incredible as a passage that no sermon, no talk seems to be able to be worthy of it and to be able to do it justice. It's really well known, and we're going to be looking at the setting of the story, the story itself, which we're going to go through two times, the story of sometimes called the prodigal son, I'll call it the story of the two sons, and then we're going to look at the significance of the story. It's Jesus' longest story. It's 388 words long. Wow. Only about 3 minutes long. And so you think about a story that is so powerful that is so short. 62% is about the younger brother, which is why we tend to think of him as the focus of the story, and 38% about the older brother. In the earliest manuscript, and the earliest manuscripts, by the way, do have paragraphs. In the earliest manuscript, it's just in one paragraph. That's in Rome. And the story just rushes on between the two brothers. That's absolutely right. But it's also divided into two sections in another way, that when you get to the end of the bit about the younger brother, it's got the father saying, "My son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And that's the same phrase you get at the very end of the story, with one little difference. Instead of saying, "My son," it says, "Your brother," as he addresses the older brother. So let's read the story. Every single word counts. It's simply incredible. We're going to start chapter 15 and verse 1 and 2 to get the setting. And then we're going to skip over the lovely stories of the lost sheep and the lost coin, which are part of the whole parable, and we'll refer to those, and then we're going to go on to verse 11. "Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him, and the Pharisees and scribes grumbled, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" Verse 11. "And he said, 'There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that's coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his field to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, and I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he's received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I've slaved for you, and I've never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, came, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you're always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. It's an amazing setting that we have for this story, because not only do we have Jesus and his disciples, we have four other groups that we can divide into two groups of two. We have tax collectors and sinners. Now, tax collectors are toll collectors. They cream off something from whatever you carry around. If you're a tradesperson, they take some. If you got you're selling fish, they're going to put a tax on that, whatever it is. And they're working, collaborating with the Romans. Then you've got sinners who presumably are in long-term breach of the law of Moses or any laws that people have added after that time. And what we hear about these tax collectors and sinners is that they are drawing near to hear Jesus. What's the very last word of the previous chapter? Jesus saying, "Let the one who has ears to hear, hear." What does a devout Jewish man pray every day? "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." What are these undevout people, these sinners and tax collectors doing? They are hearing Jesus. Then we've got the other two groups. The scribes, the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the separators. They are the good people who separate themselves from bad things. They spend their time keeping the law. They are very righteous. And the scribes, we're so thankful for them because they spend their time copying out the Bible. Isn't that really great? They know the Bible mega well because they just copy it out, every phrase, particularly the first five books of the Bible. So they are the other group. And what are they doing? They're grumbling. Oh, who in the Old Testament grumbles? Isn't it Israel in the desert? So those are the two groups that we've got. And there seems to be some sort of reversal because the bad guys are doing the right thing and the good guys are doing the wrong thing. And then Jesus tells what is described as one parable to them. First, 1% of the sheep go astray. Okay, we've got 100 sheep and one goes astray. It's lost, going away, and the shepherd finds it and brings it home and rejoices. Then we have 10% of the woman's coins, 1 out of 10, lost. What's the next percentage we expect to come up? Well, 1, 10, maybe 100. So when we get to the final bit of the parable about the two sons, really the implication is that both sons are lost. But you see, the sheep is lost by going away from home and is found and there's rejoicing. And then the coin is lost at home and is found and there's rejoicing. And then we have this story of the two sons, and one of them comes home and there's rejoicing, and then the story ends without an ending. As in, there's the missing thing of how does it end? When the older brother's complained and the father's gone out to him, how does the older brother respond? And we don't know, it doesn't tell us. But if you use the Sudoku method, of, you know, you've got enough numbers in there, you can fill in the other bits. You know that if he had responded correctly, there would be rejoicing because the woman rejoiced when she found the coin at home, you see? So that's how brilliant Jesus' story is. It begins, a man had two sons. Now, already there, we can see a sign of authenticity. This really does come from Jesus, because over in Matthew's gospel, you've got a completely different story. Matthew chapter 21, verse 28, which begins, a man had two sons. It tells about, you know, he tells one to go into the vineyard, and he says, yeah, and then doesn't. And he tells the other to go, and he says, no, and does. And then Jesus concludes, Matthew chapter 21, verse 32, for John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him, but the tax collectors and prostitutes believe him, and even when you saw it, you did not afterward change your minds to believe him. In other words, it's again the same story, and one level is what we've got here. The bad people responding, and the good people not. Jesus begins his story, a man had two sons. And the younger of them asks for his inheritance, which is a pretty shocking thing to do. And what is also shocking is that the father gives it to him. Oh, but he doesn't give it to him, he gives it to them. And this is a really important point to get. This is the most generous father you can imagine. When one son asks for his inheritance, he gives it to both. Now, what country does this take place in? We don't know. It's a story. But we know that in Old Testament law, if you had an older brother, they inherited twice as much as anyone else. Deuteronomy 21, verse 17. So the older brother does pretty well out of this. Soon, the younger son goes away, and he wastes his possessions. Now, that's an interesting word. Doesn't come up very often, but it comes up at the beginning of the next chapter of Luke, where Jesus tells a story about an unjust steward. We'll look at it tomorrow, an unjust manager who wastes money. So we've got two stories next to each other about wasters. What do you think about people who waste money? Say if the government wastes your taxpayer money, how do you feel? Not very good. Angry. Who's listening to this? Pharisees, who, it tells us in chapter 16, are lovers of money. So this man wastes money. And, you know, when it's wasted, there are so many ways of wasting money. It's just gone, gone, gone. But we're not given the details of how he wasted them, other than it's reckless living. Now, this is a difference between how Jesus tells a story and how we would tell the story. Because we would make a whole film about the reckless living, right? That would be the film. People often do this in fiction. That's the entire story, is the story of the prodigal son, is that. Jesus does it in one word. Because sin is incredibly boring. I mean, when you hear about sin, a story of sin, and you sometimes have to hear about a story of sin in order to deal with a pastoral situation, you're never better off for having heard about the story of sin. Sin is unedifying, it is boring, therefore Jesus omits it from the story. The details of the many different ways you can waste money are left to your imagination, which is a good place for them to be, not so that you can think about how you waste money, but so that it can relate to any situation. It's not too specific. So what he does, he tells us this man wastes his money. Then we hear the amazing detail that there is a famine. Now, this is something that people often forget in the story, and it's been shown that when you tell the story in context where there have sometimes been food shortages, of course, they always remember this, and in countries where there haven't been, they don't. But this is absolutely vital. Because we think of the man as the prodigal son and he gets into trouble because he wastes his money. He's also prodigal and unlucky. Because it says there was a famine in the country he went to. He happened to choose the one country where there was a famine. Bad luck, wasn't it? Now, that's not how the older brother sees it. As far as the older brother sees it, his situation is only because of his sin. But actually, Jesus, with perfect balance, tells us this man was a waster and he was unlucky. Then he gets a job. It's not really a job, is it? I mean, he's not getting any pay. And who's he working for? Oh, he's working for a citizen. Well, that's sort of quite painful, isn't it? It sort of rubs it in because Jesus, every word counts as he tells this story. And he's feeding pigs. At this point, the Pharisees are thinking, wow, this story is going well. I like this story. This is a good story. The man is getting what he deserves, feeding unclean animals. And then he gets to eat the pig food, doesn't he? No. No, he doesn't get to eat the pig food. He wanted to eat the pig food. But no one gave him anything. Now, what happens if you have no food? You're starving, you die of hunger. And so he gets to this lowest point when he's actually dying of hunger, and that's the point at which he wakes up. Why does he wake up? He doesn't tell us, but what it does do is it gives us a view inside his mind by allowing us to listen to his speech to himself, where he addresses himself and he realizes that he needs to go back home, he needs to admit his guilt. It's better to be a servant back home than to be where he is. And so he returns. And the whole return from the pigsty to the kiss is one verse. But it's amazing how he returns and the father sees him. The father has been looking for him for a long time. Now, what should the father feel? the father should feel anger. I mean, if your money has been wasted, don't you feel angry? But he doesn't. He is filled with compassion, and then he does three things. Now, this is where, again, if you were making a film, this would be a climactic thing. This would be where the music would go up, because he runs and he falls on his neck and he kisses him. Now, we know that, so we're not so sort of surprised by that, because you're familiar with his story. But then he doesn't say a single word to him. He addresses the older brother. He talks to him. He doesn't say a single thing to the younger son. Why not? Because he doesn't need to. His actions have spoken. The son begins his speech about how he's no longer worthy and so on. But he doesn't get to finish his speech. You look at the difference between the speech that he prepared in his head and the speech he delivers, and he's cut off. And he's cut off by the very first word from the father's mouth, literally is quick. For all of these years, the father's been waiting, and now he's in a rush. I mean, like, what's another hour matter? Another minute? I mean, does it really matter? But when someone comes back after being away for so long, there is no time to waste. Quick, he says to the servants, whose presence we can assume. Jesus tells a story without having to use extra words. It's amazing. He says, quick, bring out the best robe. Now I want you to start feeling angry. Who's the best robe belong to? Well, it's either the father or it's the older son, who's been given everything. And then he says, give him a ring. I've been wondering about whether I can liken this to a credit card. You know what happened last time. Now, it's not quite that, but a ring is not just, you know, a piece of jewelry. It's a symbol of authority. It gives him the power in the farm setting to give orders, shoes on his feet, and then bring the fattened calf, which will give you 500 portions of meat. And let us celebrate, for this my son was lost and is found. He's dead and alive again, lost and is found. What amazing reception, and what an uncomfortable reception. Don't you feel uncomfortable at the father's generosity? I mean, hasn't he given everything to the older brother? So how can he now be giving stuff to the son? That's the thing I want us to wrestle with. Now, it's a story, and not everything in this story is analogous to everything in the gospel, okay? But it is nevertheless a picture of God's heart, and God's heart is uncomfortably generous. We think that if someone comes back, they should be made to wait. They should do probation. They should spend some time, and maybe after they've shown themselves worthy in a year's time and they've worked hard on the farm, maybe you can earn a ring. And here, this father publicly shows him, this wastrel of a son, to be absolutely accepted, to have the best robe. Everyone in the village, wherever it is, can see that this son is fully reinstated instantly. God is incredibly generous. Let's go on to the next scene. The older brother was in the field. What was he doing in the field? Working late, presumably. And he drew near to the house. And we see how the words near and far are used. Because the father saw the son afar off. The son went into a far country. And now the older son draws near. But though he draws near, his heart is far away. He hears the music and dancing. Oh, by the way, no one had bothered to tell him there was a party on. He asks the servant what's going on. The servant gives a totally deadpan answer. Just describes, you know, in factual terms that the other son has returned. Completely different from the father's reaction. My son was dead and is alive again, lost and is found. Deadpan. But then you can see the emotional contrast then, as the older brother flares into anger. He won't go in. So the father comes out. And then the older brother starts, look! What's the missing word? The missing word is father, isn't it? All three times in this story that the younger son talks to his father, twice out loud and once in his head, he calls him father. He may have gone a long way away, but he was always closer in his heart than this man. He says, look, all these years I've been slaving for you. Actually, on whose farm have you been working? Who owns the farm you're working on? Whose business have you been building up? He's been building up his own business. He's a son who thinks of himself as a slave. I've slaved for you, and you never gave me a young goat so that I might eat with my friends. Oh, you've been vegetarian on the farm all these years. Really? Is that plausible? You never gave me a young goat so that I could eat with my friends. Who's supposed to be on the guest list? He's been able to have friends around. He owns the farm, right? But he wants to have a celebration. The father wants a celebration. He wants a celebration. But he wants a celebration with his friends and implicitly not with his father. All those times he's eaten meat with his father, it hasn't tasted as good. He wants to be away from his father. But when this son of yours, who's devoured your property with prostitutes, came, you killed the fattened calf for him. Matey, you're only just in from the field. Like, how do you know how your younger brother spent his money? Has he been sending you postcards from the brothel? There's only one possible source of information, his imagination. And why is he imagining that? Yes. This son of yours, he's not my brother. You killed the fattened calf for him. Well, actually, everyone can celebrate. So how does this brother respond? He responds thinking that somehow the younger son coming back is taking away from what he's got. He feels he's losing out on his inheritance. There's plenty there. There's plenty on the farm. Everyone can celebrate. And the father ends saying, everything I have is yours. This is a father who is generous to the younger son and to the older son. Everyone's welcome, but you can exclude yourself. How does the older son respond? We don't know, but it's an invitation to respond the right way. Well, that's the first time through the story. Let's have another go. I want us this time to think about the audience, because this is like a Pixar movie. You know a Pixar movie? A Pixar movie has jokes for the adults that the kids don't get, right? Now, it's not jokes here, but Jesus is talking to Bible experts, the people who know the Bible the best. He begins a story, a man had two sons. Who in the Bible is famous for only having two sons? Two and only two sons? Well, that would be Isaac, wouldn't it? He has two and only two sons. Oh, yes, and the younger one goes off into a far country. Jacob goes off into a far country and looks after animals. But he goes off with nothing and comes back with an awful lot. So there's a difference there, isn't there? But then we remember how Jacob had cheated his brother Esau out of his inheritance. And we remember how Esau came in saying, I am dying of hunger, just like the younger brother in this story. And so Jesus is using this story of Jacob and Esau. Oh, and Esau got so angry that Jacob had to go away. Oh, and by the way, how did Jacob cheat his father who could not see very far? Oh, yes, of course, he put on his brother's robes. And what was the food that he gave? Young goat. And is that the only other time in the Bible we have a story where people are having a meal of young goat? Oh, yes, it is. And if you're a scribe, you count these things. And so Jesus is telling this a story. But what's so amazing is that the father runs, embraces, and kisses. Those three things. Now, if you're a scribe, you know there's only one place in the entire Bible that someone runs, embraces, and kisses someone else. Where does it happen? Let's read it. Genesis chapter 33. Genesis chapter 33 and verse 4. And this is the most surprising turn of events, I'd say, in a story in the whole Bible. Jacob has been petrified of his older brother Esau, who's coming towards him with 400 men. He's cheated his brother out of his inheritance. He expects his brother to be furious. And what happens? Genesis 33 and verse 4. We read this. Esau ran to meet him and embraced him, fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. This is the amazing thing about Esau. Esau, who was a bad guy in the Bible, who preferred soup to God. He, who had been cheated out of everything, forgave his brother. We've got a picture coming up on the screen. Need to have a Hebrew manuscript every now and then. And so here we have actually two Hebrew manuscripts. This one from St. Petersburg and the one on the right from London. This is the oldest complete Bible, Old Testament we have, and the other one's a very early one. You can see where the arrow is, just here. We've got a word just to the left. It's the same word here and the same word there. It's clearer on this one. See these dots? Those are over the word, he kissed him. There are only five places in Genesis, 10 places in the whole Torah, that scribes had to put dots. It was part of the special scribal training. We know it goes back to at least a century after Jesus, when they had already forgotten the origins of this. So almost certainly it goes back to the time of Jesus. Part of the scribal training was that they actually had to put dots over these words because of a textual dispute that was going on. And they all knew this verse super well. Every scribe knew this point. So one of the verses that they knew best in the Bible corresponds with the most climactic element in Jesus' story. Thank you, we'll have that off now. And what's so amazing is that Jesus tells that story engaging with the scribes. But it's not just it's the story of Jacob and Esau. It's also the story of Jacob and Laban, who says, all these years I've been working for you. Oh, I thought Jacob said that to Laban, didn't he? I worked for you so long. Oh, and then we got the time that the father gives the son the ring and the robe. Who in the Bible gets given a ring and a robe? Oh, that would be Joseph, wouldn't it? In Genesis chapter 41, verse 42, where he comes before Pharaoh and Pharaoh gives him a ring and a robe. Oh, by the way, and Joseph is at a time of great famine and he's the only other son that the father thought was dead and is alive again. He also went to a far land and he was not sexually unfaithful there. Who was? Oh, Judah was sexually unfaithful. Genesis chapter 38. When is the only time in the Bible when you get friend, goats, and prostitutes together? That would be Judah, wouldn't it? Yeah, the person from whom the Jews derived their name, who was being sexually unfaithful while his brother in a far country was being faithful. Oh, this is quite a clever story, isn't it? Not just that. It's the story of Abraham, isn't it? I mean, Abraham is the great father figure in the Bible, the father of many nations. He also is the first guy in the Bible to run and the only other old guy in the Bible to run. He was 99. I think scribes noticed that. When he ran, it was because he was welcoming three guests. Genesis chapter 18, worth looking at. Genesis chapter 18 is simply an amazing passage. And by the way, why does Abraham get to preside over the heavenly feast? Well, he did a pretty good job welcoming God, and God's no one's debtor. So, Genesis chapter 18, it goes like this. The Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre as he sat by the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing there in front of him. When he saw them, he ran to the tent door to meet them and bowed to the earth and said, O Lord, if I found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought, wash your feet, rest yourselves under the tree. While I bring a morsel of bread, that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you've come to your servant. So they said, do as you've said. And Abraham went quickly to the tent and said to Sarah, and what's the first word from his mouth? Quick. Quick, three seers of fine flour, knead it and make calves, cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd another time and took a calf. quick running, leading to the fatted calf. It's all there. And he says to Sarah, quick, three seahs of fine flour. That's the number that comes up in Jesus' shortest parable, Matthew 13, verse 33, where a woman takes yeast and puts it in three seahs of flour. So Jesus is using the Old Testament story. It's not just that. Abraham was a great welcomer. He was also the only other person to give away his inheritance while he's still alive. Genesis chapter 25, verses 5 and 6, it says that he gave away his inheritance all. He had two sons. He had a few more later, but he had two sons, and he gave it all to the younger son. Why did Ishmael, the older son, not get anything? That's all in Genesis 21. Because the Ishmael despised the feast given in honor of the younger son, Isaac. And as a result, it said he was cast out of his inheritance. Quite a warning, isn't it? If you know your Bible. Because it's not just that Jesus puts these references in. Every single one of them makes a moral point. Abraham gave lavish entertainment to complete strangers. Ishmael despised the feast for his younger brother and was cast out of his inheritance. Esau, though he'd been cheated out of everything, forgave. Laban had to come to terms with the fact that Jacob was going to have all the stuff that used to be his. Joseph forgave what his brothers did to him. And what about them? Do the scribes and Pharisees listen to the story and hear these references or not? We don't know. But we know that on Judgment Day, they will know. Jesus tells a story which you don't need any expertise to understand. It will go across any culture, this story. And we get it, that the Father's heart is to welcome back the lost. You don't need cultural background to understand that. And yet he tells a story in which there are deep, deep layers. And you can go on in it. And how do you need to get that story? You need to hear it. You need to have ears to hear. Because it's a morally structured story. You can go away completely unimpressed by this story. Or you can have a heart to hear. And realize, I need to respond. So let's come on, finally, in the last few minutes, to consider the significance of the story. Well, I hope one thing you come away from today is just a sense of awe at the brilliance of Jesus and his storytelling. Someone said to me last night, some people can't even teach one group of people. Jesus could teach two groups of people simultaneously. I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? To do that. That is just, and to be able to do it in such a way that, that there's moral challenges for the top scribes in the class, at the same time as it's just an invitation to everyone. And so it's a challenge to us, I hope, for us to get more deep into the scriptures. There's so much more to find out. But there's also a challenge in this story when we think about the Father's heart. Here is a father who is so generous, and he is like God. Now, I don't want to say that the characters in the story stand for characters outside the story. It's a bit more complex than that, because we can be challenged to be like the Father, you see? So if we just say the Father's God, then we're not challenged to be like the Father, you see? Or we might say, well, is the Father the Son? Is the Father Jesus Christ? You know, who welcomes people? I don't want to get into that. It's a story which calls us to itself, you see? Calls us to respond. We need to have the heart that that Father has. But it's a picture of the heart of God. And however far you've gone astray, and there may be some here who have been straying and know, just feel they can't come back. The Father says, he welcomes you back, and welcomes you back completely, unconditionally. But for a lot of us, we may be more like older brothers. Physically very close. After all, we're at the forum. But how close are we in our hearts to God? And God speaks to us, and he challenges us and says, all that I have is yours. But it's easy for those who are inside to not want people from the outside. The scribes and the Pharisees were very uncomfortable at the fact that Jesus was eating and accepting tax collectors and sinners. And we can structure the church so that there are these outsiders and then there's us. And we're a bit threatened if they come in because that might take away some of our sense of a privilege. And what we need to know is God's got enough resources to give things to everyone. And we need to orientate ourselves and our churches and our organizations to be prioritizing those who are outside. That's what Jesus does in his story, in his invitation. So there is a challenge to those who are religious and may have been in churches for many years. But also we need not to be centering everything on them. We need to recognize that the Father's heart is to welcome people. That Father's heart is to rejoice over those who are lost. The celebration over the one who's gone further astray seems to be bigger. God's rejoicing over everyone who comes to him, whether they are physically near or far away. And this is a challenge to each of us, that God's heart is so great, he wants us to be close to him. Will we come in and celebrate?